This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to Live and Learn. Have you been caned as a child, or do you cane your children to discipline them? 5 months after the media commotion over the legality of child caning in Malaysia, I'm revisiting that subject with Shamila Sakharin, lawyer and chair of Voice of the Children, by examining the 15-year-old Child Act and what it says about what constitutes child abuse, as well as whether the entrenched place of the cane in society can be legislated away. The backlash came because the public thought even caning at home, parents would be brought to court. What do you think that sentiment represents, that there's this backlash who believe caning is a part of the fabric of Malaysian parenting?
You know, this is an interesting question because there are two parts. One is something which is sanctioned, state-sanctioned, something which as a nation, as a society, we're saying is okay or is not okay. And the other one is a private view, or in inverted commas, what may be perceived as a private right. So if we take the first one, what is done by the state. So it's not just court-sanctioned caning, it's also corporal punishment in schools. Both of those really don't achieve their purpose. Children have been caned for a whole variety of reasons, and I'm not certain that these children are set on the right path. There are other ways of dealing with this, whether it's in school or in terms of the kinds of sentences that the court metes out. But in terms of parenting, again, similarly, really, I think it's time that we moved away from thinking that caning is the way forward, or punishing the child by hitting them is the right way of teaching and training a child. It is the easier way. It is the way that perhaps gets a child to stop things in the fastest manner. But very often you find that children are being caned and caned and caned. And I'm not talking about, you know, the kind of abuse where a child almost dies from being caned. I'm talking about what most parents do. You know, they slap the child, or they hit them on the hand, or they threaten them with the rotan, you know, that kind of thing, the kind of average nurturing, what is part of the average nurturing of a child. Even that, really, it's the easier option, but it's not necessarily the best option. It's not necessarily the option that creates the right kind of relationship between parent and child. Really, parents need to spend a lot more time with the child, talking to them, finding out, you know, children don't do things just because they feel like it. Most children don't. They do things because, or they react in a particular way because of a lack of understanding or a miscommunication between parent and child. So, you know, for example, a child that goes to the supermarket with a parent. Now, the child only thinks about the fact that he or she wants sweets. So how do you get a child who's throwing a tantrum to stop throwing that tantrum in the middle of a supermarket, which does not involve hitting the child and getting them to stop? Well, chances are, if you hit the child is going to cry a lot more, you know, and is going to cry louder. So there are ways of talking to a child, and really this must start at home. It's not something that suddenly happens when you go out to the restaurant to eat, or a supermarket. There are ways of distracting a child. There are ways of telling a child, look, you're allowed sweets at certain times and not at other times, you know. And what we often find when you speak to parents, or when you look at the way parents talk to children, very often they bribe children, you know, to get the child to stop doing something or to do something. They say, okay, I'll give you something that you want, whatever it is, you know. I'm using sweets as a, you know, as an example, but it's not necessarily sweets. It's they know what the child wants and they bribe the child. That is not necessarily the best way of parenting, because it then gets the child, it teaches the child that if I want that thing that I want, sweets, then I need to behave in a way where the parents are going to bribe me and give me the sweets that I want, you know. But there are, I mean, I've seen many parents who have moved away from hitting the child, who've moved towards talking to children and explaining to them. And it's amazing how young, at what young age, children are able to understand. 2 years old, I remember, you know, with my sister and her son, he was about two, just over two. and we were all supposed to go out, and then he announces, I'm not going, at the age of two. And of course, what do we think, you know? Just pick the child up and buckle them in the car. But, you know, my sister sat and spoke to him and said, and they had a little chat, and then she left him sitting on the step. And I said, look, you know, why don't you go out and I will stay back if he doesn't want to go out, because obviously we can't leave him alone at home. And she said, no, we'll see. And when it was time to go out, 15 minutes later, he had, you know, got his shoes on and he was ready to come out with us. She didn't need to hit him. She didn't need to kind of be physical in any way, like pick him up forcefully. She just chatted with him. But it's something that started from the time he was young. You know, and that is what a lot of parents are not doing. A lot of parents are allowing children to dictate to them at a young age. And then when the child becomes a little bit older, that relationship has already been set up. But then, you know, the parents aren't liking it. So that's when they turn to a harsher way of dealing with the child.
On the subject of caning, how does the Child Act define corporal punishment?
Corporal punishment is caning, mm-hmm. with, you know, whether it's in school or through the court. It's not defined specifically, but it involves caning with a stick.
Because there's a line between physical abuse and physical discipline, isn't it? And in most, I think, in many parents' mind, caning is just a disciplinary tool that will inflict some pain but not injurious. Whereas in court, if it's a court-sanctioned caning, it's bound to create injury. Isn't there a difference?
No, because even parents who cane their children at home, which still happens, you know, they still use the feather duster or, you know, an implement to cane the child or to discipline the child, very often that leaves an injury. It leaves a mark, which fades in time, but it does leave a mark.
So that counts as abuse as well?
Well, in our definition it would, mm-hmm. but I'm sure, you know, if you spoke to a lot of parents, they would actually think that that goes towards disciplining the child, you know, that the mark helps you remember for at least a week while the mark is still there, that it helps you remember that you're not supposed to do whatever the action was.
Then wouldn't court canings be considered as child abuse?
Absolutely. Yeah. It is abuse. There, you know, this is it. Just because something is sanctioned by law does not mean that it is not abusive, you know? The only thing is that no one's going to charge the person who's meeting out the punishment, whether it's the discipline master in school or within the court system, no one is going to charge that person for abuse. Similarly, parents today are not going to be charged if they can show that, you know, they didn't thrash a child until the child was near death, which, you know, there are those cases, and we've read about them in the newspapers, where, a parent just goes into a rage and takes a buckle to the child, you know, the belt, but the buckle part of the belt or some other implement, and then the next thing we know, the child has passed out, they've ended up in hospital, and then, you know, the story comes out, the child would not stop crying, and so, you know, I hit the child and, you know, there's yeah. internal injuries as well. But it is abuse, you know. Anytime you hit someone, it's abuse.
Because corporal punishment is allowed in schools, do families or parents have legal grounds to bring charges against headmasters or teachers if they found the force that was delivered was excessive? Or even in court, for example, if the trauma that the kid sustained is too much, is there legal grounds to bring charges against the government?
That would be an interesting case to bring. At the moment, no such case has been brought. The success of it would be interesting because, you see, what you're talking about is not whether or not someone had the right to be caned or whether caning is the right kind of punishment, but that it was too forceful. So you would need doctors, you would need psychologists, you need a whole bunch of people to come forward and say, yes, it was too forceful. And how that would be played out would be interesting. Technically, yes, mm-hmm. you could bring such a case. But at the moment, it's not really defined as, you know, how many, I don't know what the right terminology, how many kilometers an hour the caning yes. comes down, you know. Right. I don't think that it's been defined as to what is too forceful.
I'm speaking today to Sharmila Sekharan, lawyer and chair of Voice of the Children. Up next, I'll ask Sharmila about the gaps currently in children's services. BFM 89.9. Good afternoon and welcome to Live and Learn. On the show today, we're talking about the Child Act with Sharmila Sekharan, lawyer and chair of Voice of the Children. Families who can't necessarily afford the best legal advice, are they at a disadvantage when it comes to sentencing?
You see, there is an aspect of that. The Legal Aid Centre, the Bar Council and all the state bars have legal aid centres which do representation of children. So poor parents or poor families do have access to that. And there is mitigation in the child court as well. But what you often find also is the fact that the more urban or wealthier parents would rather handle things differently. So they may take on some of the responsibility. So, for example, if you have a variety of sentences which could be meted out, caning being one of them, a parent may kind of say, well, look, you know, we will take on more responsibility. Don't cane the child or don't send the child away, you know, that kind of thing, to a detention center. Whereas poorer families may find or may feel that they cannot discipline their own children and therefore leave it up to the court or the state to discipline the child. So there are a variety of reasons why that could happen, but it's hard to say exactly why.
We take it for granted that caning is a very culturally specific Asian or Malaysian trait, but is it really?
Oh no, caning has been happening around the world for generations, you know. It's not an Eastern or Western or Northern or Southern culture. It's the way that people have been dealing with children since time immemorial, but a lot more research has been done in more recent times. So as we know from the incident from last year, Sweden was one of the first countries, or perhaps the first country in the world, in the early 70s that outlawed caning or outlawed corporal punishment, even within the home. But, you know, in the UK, in America, in Australia, in a lot of other countries, in Africa, caning is one of the punishments, both at home as well as through the state, whether it's in school or as a means of court-sanctioned punishment. So no, it's not a Malaysian thing or an Asian thing. It's something that has been happening, but a lot more research has been done into whether it's actually helped the child. And what we have to remember is sometimes the wrong that children do, they outgrow as they grow up. You know, it's not something that they will necessarily carry on doing as they grow up. Now, the argument may be that, but they stopped doing it because they were caned. But if you actually look at children and talk to children and see the behavioral patterns, as people mature, what they thought was okay at one point, for example, doing something foolish like stealing the cone on the road because, you know, they're teenagers and think that's the biggest joke in the world, mm-hmm. they're not going to do when they're 30 or even in their 20s. They're busy doing other things, you know. So similarly, things that a child does from a young age, they outgrow as they mature, you know, whether from 2 to 5, from 5 to 8 and 8 to 10 and so forth. So just because they were spanked or caned is not necessarily indicative of the fact that they've learnt anything. So the other thing that we have to remember is that at one point in time, children were deemed possessions of their parents. So, you know, the maxim, children should be seen and not heard. Mm-hmm. You know, things like that. So when adults are around, children have to sit quietly and act as if they're just a stool or a chair in the company of adults. You know, a lot of things have changed. And with that is the knowledge and understanding that children are human beings, little human beings, as much as an adult is. And if we, as adults, do not like to be punished by being hit or caned or, you know, basically someone's hand or fist upon ourselves, our body, then we should not be doing that to a younger person. We should not be doing that to a child. And people will often say, yeah, but, you know, I can reason with an adult. I think we'll often find that adults are more irrational than children.
Would you then extend your support on banning all judicial caning, including the adults who are convicted of murder or rape?
Well, I mean, rape is the obvious sanction where, you know, they get lashes. Yes. You know, if you look at the reason why people rape and the fact that and these are statistics that have come out, the fact that you have people reoffending. And this is the thing, I often thought that caning was supposed to be a deterrent. And I have seen how caning happens, and it is hideous. You know, people lose consciousness from having been caned. It is, your flesh just splits, and they are unable to kind of like sit or lie, because you're caned on your buttocks, you know, for adults, right? Well, all caning happens on your buttocks. Yeah, so, you know, they can't lie or sit or, you know, be on the side of their backside, basically. It is so painful. And then you wonder how someone, X number of years later, once the wounds have healed and you've been through such an experience, how they can reoffend. So it just goes to show that the caning is not a deterrent. If you've deterred someone, was it the caning, or did they rape under a particular circumstance, you know, under the influence of drugs, and you've removed the drugs factor so they don't, you know, they're not kind of like out of themselves and therefore doing the wrong thing. So yes, I think it's wholly inhumane. It's wholly degrading. There are other ways of dealing with this, and we need to be more creative. We need to be more inventive. We need to find out how we can stop someone from reoffending. And whether it is the death penalty or caning, people are still doing the same offense. I met a judge. I was away in a conference recently on juvenile justice, and I met a judge who had come to Malaysia. He's a New Zealand judge. And he said the number of times he was warned, you know, through, like, you know, when you fill in your disembarkation form and the announcements made on the Malaysian Airline flight, you're coming to Malaysian Airlines, carrying trafficking of drugs carries the mandatory death penalty, you know. The number of times he was warned about this, he said when he got off the flight, he was wondering whether he had drugs on him. You know, he's like, he felt someone speaking to him. And yet, how many times do we read of people trafficking in drugs and being charged and, you know, facing the death penalty? So that is not stopping people from trafficking drugs, because there is a far greater call or pull towards it. Similarly, when a person rapes, they don't stop and think, oh, I intend to rape, but whoops, I'm going to get caned if I get found out. And the caning is, you know, 10 lashes or whatever it is, and it's really going to hurt, so maybe I won't rape. You know, they don't think like that. When a child does something wrong, they don't think, whoops, my parent is going to hit me and therefore I'm not going to do what is wrong. They've been caned so many times as children, and they continue doing something that deserves that kind of punishment or provokes the response in a parent. So parents need to wake up and realize that if you've hit your child once and they've learned forever, fantastic. But you often find that it's the same child who's been caned and caned and caned. But, you know, sometimes you speak to siblings and it is out of fear that they don't do something. They've watched their elder sibling, older brother or whatever it is, being thrashed by the parent, and that puts the fear of God in them. and they start being good. But are they good because they know and understand, or are they good because of fear? Mm-hmm. You know? And is that what we want, to create a culture of fear where we walk around and we don't do something because we're afraid? If you look at Singapore, they get sanctioned for all sorts of things, even chewing gum. But look at the way they behave when they come out. Look at the way they behave when they're in Johor. The kind of speeding that goes on when they're traveling in Malaysia. So putting in a certain kind of law that provokes a very serious punishment doesn't necessarily change the person or help them understand any better. You know, they react out of fear, which is doesn't change the innate person. Shouldn't that be what we should be looking for? Changing the person, getting a person to realize that, oh, what I'm doing is antisocial, or what I'm doing is bad behavior generally, and therefore I need to relearn and rethink mm-hmm. how I need to behave, or how I need to react to certain things. Also, what some studies have shown is that very often children who've been hit or who have felt violence upon them, that is the way I feel, okay? I feel that I have been violated as a child. Okay, very often that kind of child goes on to abuse or be violent because they deal with violence in the way they've been taught, and that's what we're teaching them. Mm-hmm. So that's another reason why we need to change the way we deal with children.
How do you then talk to parents who give you anecdotal examples of how they've been hit themselves and they turn out fine, or even religious groups who turn to scriptures to justify corporal punishment?
You see, this is it. Sparing the rod and spoiling the child, you know, in whichever scriptural form it comes. Was that defined, or was that meant to be an actual rod, a literal rod? Or is it just a way of saying that we need to discipline our children? We need to keep an eye on them. We need to reprimand them. We need to discipline them. Disciplining a child doesn't necessarily involve hitting them. You can discipline in many other ways. You can deny them something that they really want. You want to watch your favorite cartoon as a young child, or your favorite TV program? No, you don't get to watch it because you did this wrong thing. And we also have to remember that children have got short-term memories. Depending on the age, people need to understand the way a child's mind develops. So a younger child, you cannot reprimand them down the line. So you sometimes have situations where a child has been naughty at home and the mother says, wait, the housewife mother says, wait until your father comes back. He is going to punish you. You know, that is an entire year in that child's life. Or a month, you know, I'm exaggerating. It's a long time in the child's life to wait for daddy to come back. And two things happen. One, the child has forgotten about the wrong they've done. And then suddenly they come back and they get whacked by the dad. It's like, whoa, what just happened there? The second thing is the kind of relationship that father and the child now have. Every time I see my dad, he hits me. Or, you know, you look forward to your dad coming home from work and you're all excited and you run up to him, daddy, daddy, daddy. And he's like, yeah, but first I got to hit you because your mom says you've been naughty, you know. Or even today, mothers go out to work. So it could be wait till your mom comes home, you know, where the mother kind of then meets out the punishment. Mm. But either way, you're teaching the child that when you do something wrong, the only answer is to be hit. But the child doesn't stop doing what is wrong. You know, they don't learn from that. The other thing is, so that's the issue of time. The other issue is that as a child grows up, you can find out what it is that causes a child to do what is wrong. And sometimes they may not really know, but when you make them sit down and think about it and you talk it through to them, they then discover for themselves why it is they've done what they shouldn't have done. You know, and that is a learning process for them. And it's a growing process. And it's a process that will have far more lasting and far-reaching results into adulthood than just hitting them and saying, you're not supposed to do this.
So civil societies have been registering the protests for doing away with judicial caning for a while now. Why do you think the ministry is heeding that call now, at least for the child part?
A lot of talk, workshops, discussions have been going on in terms of trying to get or to understand how we can deal better with children. And that could be a lot of it. The fact that there are a lot of good examples that are coming out from research, good examples in terms of the way other countries have been dealing with children, in terms of the results and the number of cases of recidivism, the number of cases where children go back and reoffend, in particular those who come into contact with the law, okay, into conflict with the law, and finding out how they deal with these kinds of cases. And that could be part of the reason why the ministry is now kind of paying attention.
So the ministry did say that they're in the midst of drafting the new revised Child Act and is expected to be tabled in Parliament in June. What would you like to see reviewed in the new Act?
Certainly something on the way we deal with children. I think also we need more child participation. We need to not just pay lip service to child participation, but give children opportunities to express themselves. You know, we have to realize, like I was saying earlier, that children are a very important component of society. They are the future in terms of leadership, but they are very much the present. They are here and now. And a lot of them have got a lot of good ideas. We need to start hearing them, paying attention to them. Not necessarily, this does not mean the child then leads or the child's view has to be taken and used in toto, because children also don't have foresight or experience that kind of like guides them, you know. But taking their view into account makes a huge difference. You know, we have spoken to a number of children who've been through the juvenile system, basically they're children in conflict with the law, and so many of them have told us, it's amazing, a lot of them have told us that they did not even know why they went in, what they were charged for. And then when you say, well, apparently you were charged for this, because, you know, we get it from their probation officers or you know, the person who's, like, assisting them. Apparently this is why you were charged. What have you got to say? It wasn't me. You know, you have stories where the child was in the wrong place at the wrong time, the police picked them up. You know, they were told, you have to admit because then it'll be a lighter sentence on you. So they just go along with that.
This comes back to poor legal assistance as well.
It does come back to poor legal assistance. But you see, it has to be done at every level. It's not necessarily the defense lawyer that needs to do this. When it comes to the child, the prosecutor needs to ensure that the child knows and understands why they are in court. You know, court is a very scary place, even for an adult. I see clients who are so... they exhibit so much bravado in outside, you know, outside court. They're like, I will tell the judge this, I will, you know. And then when they turn up in court, they're so meek and quiet and almost submissive. It's almost like it's a different person from the person you met earlier. How much more scary for a child, you know? And as brave as a child may act outside, they're actually not. They're actually very, very scared. And actually, like all children, and like a lot of us who still have the child within us, all you want is to turn to mommy and daddy and who will tell you it's going to be okay. And even children within the juvenile system are like that, even though they've been, you know, behaving really badly and with a lot of bravado with their gang friends, you know. But it's the prosecutor that needs to ensure that they know why they're there. The welfare officer needs to ensure that they know why they're there. The magistrate needs to talk to the child. And very often, people are just so busy, you know, these people are just so busy that the child, you know, the entire case comes and goes and the child is none the wiser. And so I met a child who's been, you know, a couple of children who've been in detention centres for 3 years, 4 years. Why were you there? Don't know. So they don't know why they were punished. So what use is the punishment then? You know, you've sent them away, you've gained them, you've... whatever the punishment was. They don't know what wrong they did. How do you expect them to correct themselves then?
So who has been dropping the ball then, like in terms of letting these children slip through the juvenile system? What can be done better? Or is there like a solution that we can work towards?
All of us, everybody. Everyone within the system, from the parents to... because a lot of parents, invariably, again, it's the poorer families because, you know, they have to take time off work. They have to find other babysitters for younger children. You know, it's that kind of thing. There are other things that are kind of preventing them from coming to court. Some of them also think, yeah, you know, I can't control you. Good luck. Go to court. You know, let the court sort you out. So they kind of like leave it to the state to then do the parenting for them. So you've got that kind of scenario. But so it's the parents, it's the prosecutors, it's the defense attorneys, defense lawyers, it's the welfare, it's everybody in the system. The welfare system is very overworked. So we do need more welfare officers who are trained and who specialize in children. Because again, in particular outside the Klang Valley, it's the same person who's handling the disabled people, people with disabilities. It's the same welfare officer handling single mothers. It's the same welfare officer handling children who are being abused by parents, you know, just whacked and or abandoned and all that kind of stuff, as well as the child who comes in contact or conflict with the law. It's very hard, you know. They're just literally, it's a 24-hour job, 7 days a week. So we need a lot more support for the welfare system. But we also need to realize that children need to be moved out of the welfare system and dealt with as children. And with that, you need to understand the way the child minds, the way the child's mind develops. So a child, for example, who's grown up in a home, like in an orphanage, okay, in a home, as opposed to with their parents, a child who's grown up with absent parents, as opposed to parents who take an interest with the child in the child, the way that child, all these children's brains develop is different.
Thank you, Shamila. I've been speaking to Shamila Sakran, lawyer and chair of Voice of the Children, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.